We don't have quorum yet, but we, in interest of time, we will get started. We'll get started with hearing Chair David's bill, House File 1236. Actually, we do have quorum now, members. And I call the meeting of the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee to order. And Representative Lunin moves adoption of the minutes from March 1st, 2017. Is there any, are there any additions or corrections to the minutes as presented? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes from March 1st, 2017, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Those minutes are adopted. Members, we'll go with Representative Davids first, and Representative New moves that House File 1236 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Chair Davids, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is the public finance bill. I think it's probably one of the shortest public finance bills in history, but I don't think there's any amendments. Okay, so we have the bill report. Maybe if Mr. Michael could give a brief description of the bill. And Mr. Michael, is this like the shortest public finance bill in the history of the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, I have not checked on that, but I wouldn't be surprised because it is definitely more succinct than is typically the case. And just so members know, this is essentially the same version of the bill that was in House File 848 that was pocket vetoed. So these are all of the same provisions that were in it, in the vetoed bill. And I think in summarizing it, the first four sections of the bill amend the capital note and certificates of indebtedness provisions for towns, Hennepin County, and statutory and home rule charter cities that will allow them to issue 20-year rather than 10-year capital notes to replace Freon in ice rinks so that they're in compliance with the environmental rules. The next provision increases the amount of Housing and Redevelopment Authority general obligation bonds, the maximum that they can issue from $3 million to $5 million. There's a change in the publication requirements for economic development authorities that allow them to publish these notices in weekly newspapers, not just daily newspapers. And the street reconstruction bond law is changed. Under current law, that requires unanimity of the city council to approve these bonds. This would revert that back to the standard majority approval. The last provision in Section 8 really is a technical terminology change for what that relates to fiscal consultants and makes it consistent with SEC rules.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Chair Davids?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And that sums up House File 1236, and I'm not aware of any opposition. No one has contacted my office, as far as I'm aware of, that has any concerns about this.
Is Mr. Bagnoli here? Does he
He's over in the Senate right now. He is certainly getting over here quickly as a resource, but I think Mr. Michael described things pretty well.
Okay. Members, any questions or discussion on the bill? Anyone else who would like to testify on or for or oppose the bill? Questions, members? House File 1236. Seeing none, Representative New renews her motion that House File 1236 be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, House File 1236 is laid over. Thank you, Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative New and members.
Members, Ms. Schill has a couple of items she would like to talk us about, some items that she has in her packet. Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a quick acknowledgement that you have in your packet an updated spreadsheet that reflects the February forecast. There is a memo from me to the rest of you that discusses what the changes between November forecast and February forecast is. I did catch a typo in that memo, but it's on the about the fifth line down. It says fiscal 18-19 the number under the November forecast should read $3,466,925 instead of $3,446,925. So that's just a brief typo. The spreadsheet will give you detailed information. The other item in that packet is an explanation about property tax refund and income tax interactions with changes in levy. If you have questions on any of these items, please let me know. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Hill, members? Quickly, Representative Markworth.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hill, would you be able to tell me why in 18, 19, and 20, 21 there's a reduction in the agricultural market value credit?
Ms. Hill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Markworth, I think that shows a reduction in the property tax values, but I will turn to Mr. Hines if he has more detailed information.
Mr. Hines, do you?
Mr. Chairman, yes, Ms. Schill's correct. There was a, I think just because of valuation effects, there was a small change in the credit this year.
Thank you, Mr. Hines and Representative Markworth. With that, we have Representative Hoppe here with House File 1592, and Representative Franke moves that House File 1592 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Hoppe, Chair Hoppe, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. It's a pleasure to be here this morning talking about soccer stadium. This is the bill that passed the House last year and the Senate last year. There are two tax provisions in the bill. The one we're here talking about is the one that continues the continuation of the property tax exemption for the site. And this, for those that don't know, this would allow the team to build the stadium, which is entirely paid for by the team, by the way, in the city of St. Paul, to bring professional soccer from Blaine to St. Paul. I'm not aware, we have a number of people that want to testify. I'm not aware of any opposition other than Representative Loeffler talked to me this morning about a question about the bill. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to the experts, and we'll turn it over to Mr. Rogers, who's the president of Minnesota United.
Thank you, Chair Hoppe. Mr. Rogers, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Nick Rogers. I'm president of Minnesota United, the professional soccer team here in Minnesota. This is a role I've been in for the last 4.5 years. Prior to that, I was an attorney in private practice. We just got done playing our first ever Major League Soccer game in Portland over the weekend. I was out there with the team. It was an incredible event. This is, as was just mentioned, a provision that was enjoyed bipartisan support in the 2016 session, something we're very grateful for, and we're hopeful to see that happen again this year. You know, our project will create at least 1,900 construction jobs, as well as 400 to 500 game day jobs. There's more than 77,000 Minnesotans actively participating in soccer every year. And, you know, we've been, you know, greatly encouraged by the excitement around our project. So, grateful to be here, and I'll turn over to Todd, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Mr. Hurley, is it? Please introduce yourself, sir.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Todd Hurley, and I'm the finance director for the City of St. Paul. As stated by the representative and Nick, this language is actually identical language from the 2016 session where there was bipartisan support for the property tax exemption for the actual soccer stadium. For those committee members who are not familiar with the stadium site, it is actually largely on the bus barn site, currently occupying the corner of 94 and Snelling. The majority of this land, again, is owned by the Met Council and termed the bus barn site, and it has been vacant for the past 10 years. The City of St. Paul has been working with Met Council and other development partners over the past 30 years to try and develop this site, but it has proved to be extremely difficult. And we're very happy and fortunate that this opportunity is now here for us to develop a soccer stadium on that site that can serve as the catalyst for the development of the rest of the mega block contained by University, Snelling, and 94. The City of St. Paul actually did finalize our site plan and our development and use agreements in August of 2016. And also continuing this property tax exemption would then put this stadium in alignment with the rest of the stadiums in the state of Minnesota as far as property tax exemption is concerned. One final point I will make is that upon completion of the construction of the stadium, the team would then turn the certificate of occupancy, the team would turn the ownership of the stadium over to the city of St. Paul, and it would actually be owned by the city of St. Paul. I want to thank the committee on behalf of the city of St. Paul and the team for hearing this bill, and I can stand for further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hurley. Mr. Hurley, just quickly, the mechanics of the bill on line 1.21 and 1.22, it says, provided that properties are subject to special assessments levied by a political subdivision. Can you tell us what that means?
Chair, committee members, what that would mean is if the city of St. Paul were to provide any public services outside in the public infrastructure around the right-of-way, that we would then bill the team for any of those types of services.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. We would like to thank Representative Hoppe for carrying this bill today. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith support Section 2 of House File 1592, a bill that provides a property tax exemption for a Major League Soccer stadium. Providing a property tax exemption would make this stadium consistent with other Major League stadiums in Minnesota. The site is currently exempt from property tax in its current use. Soccer is the fastest growing sport in the United States and is incredibly popular across Minnesota. 117 soccer associations exist as part of the Minnesota Youth Soccer Association. 66 of these associations are in the metro, 51 are in greater Minnesota. Professional soccer ranks second in popularity among 12 to 34-year-olds in the U.S., second only to the NFL. As this bill moves through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, and members on this and other important provisions. We would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this local economic development opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? I have Representative Loeffler and then Anderson. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to our witnesses, we've heard several times that this is consistent with treating this stadium as we have other stadiums, but there actually is one difference that I think we should probably address before we put it in the final bill, and that is in the Viking Stadium, the law that we passed said that the property tax exemption was applied to associated businesses, restaurants, et cetera, only if they're open 200 days or less, and that was to make sure that there was a level playing field between restaurants or other businesses that might be in the stadium with surrounding ones in the downtown area. The soccer stadium site is the home of a lot of existing restaurants, many of them ethnic and culturally diverse, and I think it would be a real disadvantage to them if the stadium design, which we have not seen the final version of, were to incorporate restaurants and other commercial businesses that are open year-round on the ground floor, competing on a property tax-exempt basis with neighboring businesses that don't have that. And I'm wondering if our witnesses could explain why that wasn't included or if they'd be willing to accept that as the bill moves forward.
Mr. Rogers? Mr. Hurley?
I think we have another guest, Mr. Chair, who's coming up to
it. Owning a friend, Mr. Carlson.
We need a taller chair on this end, Mr. Chairman, for our short people. Mr. Chairman and members, Joel Carlson, I own a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent Minnesota United, and we're very excited about the home opener next Sunday at TCF Bank Stadium. We're hoping to have a very big crowd for that awesome event. To your question, Representative Loeffler, I think you'll find in other portions of the property tax statute that those provisions that are commercial in nature and not for stadium use are not subject to the exemption. I'll be happy to share that information with you offline. I don't have it right in front of me right now. If the language needs to be tightened up to make sure that that's the case, I think we're happy to look at that. But that is not the exemption applies to the stadium only, and that's our current read of it, and we're happy to make that clear either offline to you or through other amendment language.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had noted the forced stadium use, but there's no definition of that and I think people would assume that concessions are an inherent part of an experience in a stadium, and so I think there is a question about clarity, and I think that the Viking Stadium Law was set a very nice standard for a property that is not going to be used year-round generally, and to provide a fair playing field for all the surrounding businesses.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lawford, we don't disagree with that. We need to remember this stadium is singularly unique in Minnesota in that 100% of the costs of the stadium are being borne by the team, and there isn't a taxpayer component into financing the stadium. And while I understand that provision in the Viking Stadium legislation, you have a different proposal that's in front of you right now, so the language is not comparable in several areas, that being one of them.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but I don't think that's relevant to the issue. The issue is whether or not surrounding businesses are being treated equally, and it doesn't matter who's paying for the stadium or who isn't. It's whether or not there's fair competition amongst various business owners in that neighborhood, and I think that's something we should look for in terms of fairness with everyone. It's worked well with the Viking Stadium. I've heard no complaints from anyone on it, and I would really encourage us to be that clear moving forward.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler and Mr. Carlson. And, yeah, if you two can work those out, I think it's a fair point, and we can have discussions before it goes in the bill. Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To the City of St. Paul, with your city taking over ownership of the stadium once it's built, who's going to be responsible for the ongoing maintenance costs involved with the stadium?
Chair,
Mr. Rogers.
Chair, committee members, through the arrangements that we negotiated between the development agreement and the use agreement, all operating costs, all maintenance costs, all capital costs will be a responsibility of the team.
Representative Anderson. Other questions, members? Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From what I understand, if I can remember right from last year, it's up to 40 years that the team has responsibility for the maintenance, or 50?
Mr. Rogers. Mr. Hurley.
Chair
Hoppy.
The term of the agreement is 52 years, and that is the responsibility then of the team for 52 years.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that sounds like a pretty good deal, and look forward to your home game.
Other questions, members? Okay. With that, any other closing comments, Chair Hoppy?
Mr. Chair and members, we'll talk about Representative Loeffler's concern offline, and we'd like to be included in the omnibus property tax bill. If that's the procedure, if you have your own bill, that does it travel on its own or get folded into the bigger omnibus bill?
We, Chair Hoppy, we put together a division report that then folds into the larger tax bill.
So you don't need to come up with your own theme song. That's good.
We don't, but we might learn that from Chair Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair Hoppy. With that, Representative Frankie renews his motion that House File 1592 be labeled for possible inclusion. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
House File 1489 is next. Representative West and Representative Anderson moves that House File 1489 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Representative West, welcome.
Thank you, Chair, members. House File 1489. Wait, did we move the bill?
Yep, it's all the skids are all greased and you're moving.
House File 1489 is an incredibly simple bill, as you'll see if you're looking at it. It just changes the value of the property of structure attached to a manufactured home, whether it's taxed or not. Current law, it is taxed if it's worth $1,000 or more, but we're changing that to $10,000 or more. And the reason is this tax is incredibly small, and many, many, many times, due to the way manufactured housing is sold, bought and sold, the tax goes unpaid. And when it goes unpaid, then it goes to collections, and there's all these fees and interests associated with that. And that's an incredible burden on the manufactured housing community because they're not particularly equipped to deal with those kind of surprise impacts. And the tax is incredibly small when you're talking about something around $1,000. So bringing it up to $10,000 makes the tax a lot more reasonable when it is triggered, and it'll save a lot of grief for the people who don't pay the tax because they don't realize that they are being assessed on this, like, $20 or so impact. And I do have a testifier that can go into more detail.
Thank you, Representative West. Ms. Gase? Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Cindy Geiss. I am the Auditor Treasurer for Scott County, but I'm here as a legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of County Officers, MACO. No, it's not where you get your car done, but it's the other type of MACO. But anyway, I'm here. I thank Representative West for carrying this bill forward to you. When we started talking about the items that we were going to try to move forward from a MACO perspective, we were looking at ones that are really that makes sense from the taxpayer's perspective as well as the county's. Currently, any ancillary structure, a small deck, anything else that's put onto or attached to a manufactured home and or even just a park trailer has to be sent, those people get sent a personal property tax. The tax on most of these is approximately $10 to $15 to $16 on such a small, small value. The cost for an assessor to go out there and assess the property, come back with a value, put it into the system, us to calculate a tax, send it to a print vendor, print the thing, put it in an envelope, and send it to the taxpayer is much more costly than the tax itself. So when we're looking for efficiencies for the purposes of the taxpayer and the knowledge that they have as far as what this tax is really for, as well as for the county to be able to process these, we recommend that the value of that gets increased to the point where that ancillary structure or whatever it is that they built truly has a value that's worth taxing.
Thank you, Ms. Geiss. So what is, Ms. Geiss, what is the amount of the tax if you're at $10,000?
I would say, well, the average tax is going to be approximately $125. So, I mean, you're looking at an average tax rate of 125% normally, and that goes at a 1 to 1.5%. On these, it's generally homestead on a manufactured home, so it'll be going at a 1% tax capacity.
Thank you. Questions, members? Okay. Final comments, Representative West.
Thank you for hearing the bill.
Thank you. We like that succinct and direct closing. With that, Representative Anderson moves that House File 1489 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative West and Ms. Geiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Howell. Is Representative Howell here? Representative May Quaid, are you here? 1096? Okay, Representative Yawakim moves House File 1096 to be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the Property Tax Committee, Representative May Quaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, members, I want to tell you three parts about my bill. Currently in law, service-connected 100% disability veterans have a $300,000 property tax exclusion that does extend to their spouse. 70-80-90, they have a $150,000 property tax exclusion, and it does not extend to their spouse. This year, Chair Detmer, Chair of the Veterans Committee, brought a bill to the committee that would lift the 8-year cap that exists on these property tax exclusions, and I brought to him an amendment that I would like to have, and the amendment was this bill, and he said this would make a great first bill. Why don't you make it your own bill? I'll sign on as number two. So that's this bill. This bill would have the $150,000 property tax exclusion that 70-80-90% service-connected veterans get extend to their spouse. It does track with Chair Detmer's bill that removes the 8-year cap, and so it would be indefinite. And I also want to tell you about the constituents that actually brought me the bill or the amendment at the time. So J and V are constituents of mine. This summer when I was door knocking, I met them, and J is 70% service-connected disabled, but he also has a terminal illness that's unrelated to his service to our country. And J and V have two children in college, and they're very concerned about when J passes away, how they're going to be able to maintain their house and continue to send their students or their kids to school. And this bill is really important to me because it's not just our veterans that serve our country, it's their families too. And we should honor the decision that usually goes into making the decision to buy a home with a property tax exclusion. We should make sure that their families are taken care of after they pass. So with that, I will turn it over to the committee for questions.
Thank you, Representative May Quaid. Is there anyone else, anyone like to testify for or against House File 1096? Mr. May, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom May on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. There's many bills on the disabled veterans exclusion this year, and we've testified on all of them, and our belief is that it should be a state-funded program. And I just want to make that clear, that it would distribute the tax equally across the state, and there'd be no burden that falls on certain counties that have veterans facilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mann. I think we knew what the response was going to be. Anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Tom Diamond, DFL Veterans Caucus. I've also been testifying on a number of these bills. There's a number of pieces to this puzzle, and I think they're all good provisions that will help make it a really fine bill when we get it all together. So I'd just like to speak in behalf of it, and also keep in mind that you look at all these pieces when you come, how they fit into the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Anyone else would like to testify? Questions, members? This is, I think, is this our third or fourth bill in this area now? So we're kind of familiar with the discussion around it. No more questions. Representative May Quaid, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I do know that you do have a number of these bills before you, which is why I didn't bring testifiers. I figured you'd be very familiar with the bill, and you have a lot on your plate. The last thing I'll just say is that every day that we come to this Capitol, politics is often looked at as negative, and I want to say that this bill is a reflection of everything that's great about our political process. It was an idea from a constituent. I offered it as an amendment as a freshman to the chair of the Veterans Committee, who said, that's a great first bill. Let me sign on to number two. The chair of the Tax Committee signed on as number three. So I'm very proud of this bill and the process that it's gone through, and this is, makes me very proud to be a legislator for the work that was done in this bill specifically. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative May Quaid, and thank you, too, for the green and white cookies that have gone around. Representative Lunin really appreciates them. And my mom's maiden name was Baker, so there's others of us here that have Irish in us as well.
I'm Aaron Kathleen Sullivan hyphen May Quaid. Yeah.
Okay.
Very Irish family. Yeah.
So I can tell that you made those cookies, Representative May Quaid.
Yes, absolutely. You think the target.
Thank you. With that, Representative who moved this bill? Oh, Representative Joaquin renews her motion that House File 1096 be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative May Quaid. Representative Howe and House File 1059. Representative Lunin moves House File 1059 to be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Howe. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize. I did have a couple amendments to the bill that didn't get done, but I will promise to get you those amendments that need to be done prior to the omnibus bill, hope for a hopeful inclusion. Those amendments would have been on line 2.2 and 2.30, which would have taken out the word reapply and basically make it notify, because I think we had that question in another committee. The other thing we would have added was something that required the veteran service officer to actually verify the give a process for verification for the county to do this. This bill came to me by the county, by Stearns County. What the process that they done for this is, as the applicants come in for these, they have to reapply every year. What happens is many times they kind of forget. So the county sends out a letter notifying the veterans that you need to come in and reapply. Some do. Then they send out another letter saying, hey, you need to reapply. And some do. Then they go down the list that haven't responded yet and calls each one of them to make sure they come in and reapply. Very burdensome. They say, can't you fix this? They say, we take the list then, once they get the list that everybody reapplied, then they send it to the county veteran service officer, and the county veteran service officer, with their connection to the Department of Veterans Administration, goes through and verifies the disability amount of every one of the veterans' applications. So in conjunction, talking to the county veteran service officer, they basically said, yeah, I mean, we need the new applications, but after that, we just go ahead and we can just take the list that they have that's always been there, verify that they still are current, still have it, and that would suffice. Now, there still needs to be, if they move, had a change of ownership, that type of thing, there needs to be a notification process. But other than that, this would very much simplify the process. The county wouldn't spend an exorbitant amount of time and effort trying to verify the list. And actually, the veterans get a break on having to reapply every year. So that's the emphasis of the bill, and that's why it's here.
Thank you, Representative Howell. Anyone else? Anyone like to testify for or against House File 1059? Mr. Diamond.
Thank you, Chair. Members, Tom Diamond, DFL Veterans Caucus. I'd like to speak in support of this. And again, the important thing is that there's a lot of people who work at veterans who have been working with veterans to try and make this existing legislation, which is wonderful, is very helpful. But to make it better, make sense, some of those provisions, out when you actually try and administer it, you kind of find out, well, no, this doesn't quite work right. And so it's really helpful to take all these pieces, bring them together. Now, everybody will be better off, the veterans, and I think as far as the administration, better off. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Anyone else like to testify? Mr. May.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom May on behalf of MAAO. Again, I won't repeat our position on this issue before, but in this particular bill, I think maybe as the representative mentioned, with an amendment, we'd like to see the percentage of disability be part of the notification if that changes, and that would be our only comments on it. Otherwise, we would support the reduction in paperwork.
Thank you, Mr. May. Representative Howell, do you have any comments about that?
Well, as far as the reduction goes, if it does get reduced, that'll get picked up by the County Veteran Service Office when he contacts the VA computer system. They will verify whether that veteran's disability rating went down or increased or whatever. So we could put that in there. It's going to get picked up anyway by the county veteran service officer. So,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. May. Representative Howell, describe to us again, there's language here on 2.30 and 2.31 about verifying if there's changes in ownership, et cetera. So what exists now, and then under the bill, what do you do? Because they aren't going to be applying every year for homestead. So what do we do to make certain that if it does change ownership, that gets picked up properly by the county?
Well, there will be, when it changes ownership, it won't be too big of a deal. The bigger part of that is when they get married, because if the spouse of a service member that had 100% gets married, that stops. And so that's the bigger notification piece, that they have to notify whether their status of marriage comes in. That's the big, I think, the big hook there. Change of ownership should get notified through the property tax process anyway when that thing gets changed. But the big thing is that marriage piece. Even though But that notification, we want to put that onus on them that if they change their address, they come in and notify, because they may change their address within the county also. And although they still get the same, as long as the veteran is alive, they still get that same reduction in property tax. But if they are remarried, or if that spouse isn't there and they change their ownership, once they change ownership, that deduction or reduction in property tax goes away. So that's why that notification needs to be there.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think he might have just answered what he hit me. So if a spouse of a disabled vet or the disabled vet passes away and then the spouse moves, that deduction doesn't follow her to the new property. That's
Representative Hall.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, all that ends the reduction. Once they relocate, it's only for that piece of property as long as they stay there and are not remarried.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Hearing none, Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 1059 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative
Chair. I'll make sure I get you that amendment.
Thank you. House File 1830, Representative Bliss. Representative Rarick moves that House File 1830 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Bliss. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. And I, too, am a freshman with my first appearance in front of your committee, and I have treats over here, but we'll wait to distribute them for just a little bit. All the other cookies.
Thank you in advance.
Yep. this bill is addressing an issue that has come to my attention, that if a resort leases land from a county or governmental unit, they're also taxed on personal property tax for that land. So this bill addresses that, and it also clarifies a little bit of Class 1C homestead credits. And I'm going to let my experts testify to the details.
Thank you, Representative Bliss. Mr. McElroy, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. There are three changes in the bill, and then there is an author's amendment that has an additional change. And the first one is the first Article 1 having to do with leased property. We've been told by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service there are 17 resorts in Minnesota, in the Chippewa National Forest and Superior National Forest, that operate on leased land and have for a very long time. They pay a lease payment based on revenue to the department and have also been taxed both on the value of the land and on the value of buildings and other improvements. With me is Brian Harris. He and his wife operate Eagle Nest Lodge on Cutfoot Sioux Lake near Lake Winnie. Brian's an example, and he can tell you a little more about how this impacts them. But it really is taxing the land twice, because resort owners are paying the federal government, who is then paying a payment in lieu of taxes. Our proposal is that these resorts be taxed only for the value of their buildings and improvement, which is most of the value, but it would avoid a double taxation, Mr. Chair. Brian, if you'd give your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. McElroy, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Harris. Please.
Mr. Chairman and members, Brian Harris, my wife Susie and I operate Eagle Nest Lodge on Cutfoot Sioux, as Dan mentioned. The resort has been in operation since 1924, always on a federal lease program. It operates similarly to the ski resorts out west. They lease much of the land that they operate their ski operations on, but they lease the land from the Forest Service. Minnesota, unfortunately, is one of those states, and I think it might be the only one left, that still taxes us for land we don't own. I'm happy to pay property tax on the buildings and improvements because I do own that, but I pay the Forest Service a lease every year, a pretty healthy one, and I'll have to pay that forever. So I realize no benefit from the land. And then they, in turn, pay the county a payment in lieu of taxes. They also pay a 25% of all revenue that they generate on the forest in our county. And so it just feels wrong and it tastes bad when I'm paying taxes for land I don't own, and I'm sure you would probably feel the same.
I think we would, Mr. Harrison. By the way, I think there's treats coming around. That'll help that taste. I thought I was being helpful, Mr. Harrison. Anyone else that would like to testify for or against the bill?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner McElroy
provides information on Section 2, if I may, and then there is an amendment.
Okay.
I do have two handouts related to Section 2, if the page could help.
If we could get the page to help hand these handouts out, and then Mr. McElroy, Commissioner McElroy, please outline your point, and then we'll bring the amendment forward.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 2 of the bill proposes two changes to the 1C property tax requirements. The first one is on lines 2.31 to 2.33. Current law requires that to be classified as a 1C Ma and Pa resort, a resort has to be on a body of water, that meets the state definition, lake or stream. There are, we believe, approximately 15 resorts in the state, and the data comes in thanks to some work done at the Department of Revenue and Research from the Explore Minnesota Tourism database. There are 15 resorts that are on trails but not on lakes. They're not all federal trails, not all DNR trails. They may not all qualify. I'm aware of three resorts that that operate on state trails and would otherwise qualify for the Ma and Pa rate. As you think about it, we put resorts, our property values essentially, and other things, to put resorts under stress. In 1972, a report done by the University of Minnesota Extension Service estimated there were 3,200 resorts in Minnesota. There are today about 800 resorts in Minnesota. And they're important to the economy of their local communities, to our brand as a resort destination, and to the culture of being able to go to the lake, even if you don't own your own cabin. Where fishing and lakes were the predominant reason people came to resorts in earlier years, trails are increasingly important, and we would ask that this change would help some of resorts stay economically viable. Chair Davids carried a bill about 5 years ago to make this change in the 4C classification. We think it's important to make it in the 1C classification. The other change in this part of the law is found on, has to do with how a home is titled, and it is on lines 3.4 through 3.9. The handouts we passed out were a tax court decision involving a resort in Crow Wing County, and a letter from the Department of Revenue to Douglas County, essentially giving the opposite direction on how resorts should be qualified for 1C. If you'll notice on the current law, on line 3.5, the language says that a resort qualifies for 1C if it includes a dwelling occupied as a homestead by a shareholder of a corporation that owns the resort, a partner that owns the resort, a member of a living liability company that owns the resort, even if the title to the homestead is held by the corporation. The department's thinking on this is that even if is read as only if, and that has caused a real challenge as banks prefer to loan money to an individual for the house and to a business for the resort. We've had a number of circumstances. The one in the court case in Crow Wing County, we have two underway now, one in Otter Tail and one in Douglas County, where the homestead is in a family's individual names and the resort is in their LLC's name. it operates exactly the same as if the titles were identical. We would ask that the language be adopted on 3.15 through 3.18 to make clear that the home can be in an individual's name if the resort's in an LLC's name. Those are the changes that are in the bill itself. And then I believe you have an amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McElroy. And we will move to the amendment. There's an A1 amendment, and Representative Rarick moves the author's A1 amendment. Discussion on A1 amendment. Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. A1 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. McElroy.
With us. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The amendment deals with lines 4.17 through 4.10. The provision as currently written says the portion of the property operated as a restaurant, bar, gift shop, conference center, meeting room, or other non-residential facility operated on a commercial basis not directly related to temporary and seasonal residential occupancy for recreation purposes does not qualify for Class 1C. Over the years, the phrase not directly related to temporary and seasonal residential occupancy for residential purposes has been applied by various assessors to clauses 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. An assessor in Ottertail County recently decided that it only applies to Clause 5, and that is other non-residential facility operate on a commercial basis. There are many small resorts that have a gift shop. In many cases, it's part of a resort office. It might be in the resort owner's house. They may sell ice cream by the scoop, or they may have a small grill where they make hot dogs and hamburgers. They may sell some sweatshirts. It will be very challenging to differentiate which portion of a resort ought to be ought to be classified as commercial. Now, this may be more complex for larger 1C resorts where a restaurant may be a separate building. I'd be happy to work with staff to make the language as clear as possible, but to try and split up a lodge as part of it being part of a 1C resort and part of it being commercial is extremely complex and creates economic hardship for Ma and Pa resort owners, Mr. Chair. And so we hope that the bill as amended could be a part of your division report and the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Mr. McElroy. Members, questions? Did we ask if anyone else would like to testify for or against the bill? I think we did. Okay. We do have questions. Representative Anderson, I'm sorry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This one goes back to Section 1, talking about the leased arrangement with the Forest Service. As I understand, you pay them a lease, and then they pay a fee back or an amount back to the local government. And on a federal payment, unlike the state payment, that's not a guaranteed payment. It's based on their revenue. Can you comment? Is that payment back to the local government a guaranteed payment? It's so much every year, or does that change every year?
Mr. Harris.
You know, it's the federal government, and I'm not sure if it's a guaranteed or not, but I know they have been making a 25% payment on based up 25% of all revenue they've brought in the forest, in the county, to the county. Because a payment in lieu of taxes is a pretty small amount.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. McElroy or Mr. Harris. Maybe could you give me some sense of the idea of the difference between the PILT payment made on a particular property that you are occupying versus what you apparently must know what the property tax is that you're paying? So could you give myself and the committee members kind of a understanding of what the differential is between if it were taxed as you owned it versus the PILT payment?
Mr. Harris?
I don't have good details for you. I can tell you we paid last year a $9,000 fee to the federal government for our lease. We paid a $17,000 property tax payment for the land and our improvements. And I don't know the amount of the PILT that they paid the county. I'd be able to get that.
We can get that from the department as well, I suspect.
Yeah, and that 25% amount, I'm sure, would be a number you'd be able to get from them.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, with regard to the language, lines 2.33 through 3.2, you're specifying, or in the current law, it specifies 250 days. Is there any reason that isn't kind of the days present threshold that we have with regard to residency status and whether or not you could file a homestead? So I was wondering why it maybe isn't 183 days or something of that nature.
Commissioner McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hertaus, it is a number that's been developed over the years as to what represents a seasonal resort as opposed to a year-round resort. In the best interest of small towns and counties to encourage small resorts to be open as much of the spring and fall season as they can. And so it was a differentiator, and it goes back a very long way, but it is a different standard than whether you reside in Florida, for example. It is the kind of viability of resorts that help small town economies.
Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, testifiers.
Any other questions, members? Final comments, Representative Bliss.
Thank you for your time, and I appreciate you hearing the bill.
Thank you. With that, Representative Rarick renews his motion that House File 1830 be laid over for possible, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over as amended. Thank you. Representative Green. Representative Green has House File 1551, and Representative Erickson moves House File 1551 to be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Green, welcome to the Property Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment to this bill that's being passed around right now. But I can begin talking whenever you're ready.
Okay, it's still being passed around, Representative Green, but if you would kind of introduce the amendment and what it does, that would be great.
Okay, the amendment to 1551 allows for reclamation of taxes that were not collected when frozen. So the bill itself, what it does, it has an exclusion for those 65 or over for property tax increases due to increased valuations of their property. What the amendment does is say that when the property is sold or transferred, then those taxes that were not increased for valuations can be added on and collected at the time of the sale.
Okay, thank you. Representative Erickson moves the A1 amendment. A member's discussion on the A1 amendment is presented by the author, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I heard that right. So I'm 65 or old. I'm 85, and my taxes were froze at when I was 65. So I've had 20 years of frozen property value and frozen taxes. I pass away or I go in a nursing home and sell my home, then the person, as part of the sale, I have to pay all those back taxes, or is it the person who's buying the house has to pay all those back taxes? Mm-hmm. That's what I heard you say, and I'm going, that could put a real impediment to a house being sold if there's this huge tax bill out there. Be like a big lien against the house that had to be paid out before it be sold. Did I hear that correctly, that those taxes would then be paid back by the person buying or the person selling that house?
Representative Green or Mr. Hines? Mr. Hines, can you help us out on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, you said most accurately at one point a lien would be placed on the property, so the county doesn't really care who pays the tax, but the tax has to get paid. So you'd have to assume it was a liability on the seller because they can't, you know, that's going to be sitting out there for the seller or the buyer. But the concept is just as you described. Yes, that big amount would have to be paid.
Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Green, so we're basically not freezing their taxes. We're just reducing it for the period till they sell it, and they still have to pay all that going back. I don't know if this bill, if that, I guess, I mean, I understand the concept of giving seniors who are maybe unlimited incomes a break on their property taxes, but if they're going to have to pay it back at some time in the future, what value is it to them? And again, if it's that it gets transferred to the seller, that could make that house very difficult to sell for somebody.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Green.
I will give you a little bit of background on this, Mr. Chairman and committee members. In greater Minnesota, I'll just give you the one example of my biggest county. It's in Becker County. Right now, Becker County has about 75,000 acres of tax forfeited land. This year alone, another 37 parcels are going to be getting, people are going to be getting notice that they're delinquent enough where their property is going to be taken for back taxes. What this bill does, it is an attempt to curb that. If you've got people on fixed incomes that just can't take any more hits on the valuation of their property, then they will be able to apply for and receive this. And it's an attempt to try to ease them and keep them in their homes. To just eliminate the property tax altogether would be to shift it on to the other taxpayers. And as you can see from the fiscal note that you should have in front of you, you're looking at another maybe $19 million to the other taxpayers across Minnesota. And that's not really acceptable. But the other side of this is that even though there will be a price added on to the sale of the home, it's probably not going to be quite as severe as you think, because you're still paying the existing property tax. What you're being excused from is any increases. And so I would think that not every single person is going to apply for this, because it is going to have to be paid back if they presume they're going to have to sell their home. The people who are going to apply for this are the people who just can't pay it. And so we're not looking to shift burden. We're looking to ease the burden and hopefully reduce the number of property tax forfeitures within greater Minnesota or across Minnesota.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that. I understand. I just still think this is, it's basically we're basically saying we're putting your taxes off till a time in the future, but when that property gets sold, you're going to have to pay them then. I don't know if this is the way I would go about doing what I think he's trying to accomplish, but I'll leave it at that. I don't think this is a good way of doing it. I think we're better off if we want to give the seniors a benefit of not having their property taxes go up or go through the roof. Especially for low-income ones, that there's maybe a better way of doing this. Because at some point, the house is going to get sold. Those taxes are going to go up to the new value. And going forward, they would get that. But this is giving the counties, there's a pot of money sitting out there, and all of a sudden, the property gets sold. They're going to get a huge windfall because all those back taxes and the time in between, say the example I gave of 65 and I sell my house at 85, during that 20-year period, those taxes that that house should have paid will be shifted to other properties going during that 20-year period. I don't know if I like the way this is being done. But anyway, that's more of a comment than a question.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. And I know, members, I brought earlier in my legislative career a bill forward similar to this, and one of the things that struck me was that I didn't go forward with it further was that if you freeze the property taxes of seniors, they have no longer any reason to vote against any future referendum because it wouldn't affect them. And so, Representative Nelson, if it's helpful, one good part about this is that they at least still have skin in the game with that. Otherwise, you'd have a whole group of people who would vote yes on every referendum and force it on everyone else. So I think maybe this is Representative Green's way of trying to get around that. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to make sure I kind of understand the bill. This isn't a way like a mini this old house for improvements on homes, but only for folks over 65 on the improvements, and there's no qualification on the value of the home. It could be over the $400,000 that's in the old this old house program. It could go towards anything on the improvements, building it, doubling the size of the house. So I'm a little concerned about that. part of it, because it's just on any improvements made to the home. And I prefer a senior deferment program that we already have that has income qualifications, and I'd like to see those income qualifications be increased. But it's an interesting concept. Thank you.
Representative Green?
Well, I don't think that was a question, but yeah, the taxes, to Representative Nelson, the taxes are going to have to be paid, but somebody's going to pay them, and you're either going to stretch them out or not. And for those people who are out there who don't need this, with the fact that they're going to have to pay it back when the house is sold, I think you're not going to get folks applying for it that don't need it, because it's going to affect the bottom line of their sale. It also, for people who want to transfer their properties to their children, are also not going to be involved in this, because then that would have to be paid in one chunk. I think it is designed to, and my hope is that what it will do is just have relief for those who are just struggling trying to pay those taxes and in danger of losing their homes.
Thank you. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Joachim, I was just going to point out that the bill does actually say that an increase in value attributable to an improvement is not subject to the freeze. So if they do make an improvement, it would be added to the value and it would be taxed at the time. That's on lines 2.10, 2.11.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. I was a little confused with the summary in that. It wasn't.
Thank you. I think the author's intent here is really just the increase in valuation going forward rather than. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a good bill. This is going to be a big bill in my district, Representative, because almost every third year we have to build another school and other city functions. And to Representative Nelson's point, this targets the relief to the person over age 65, but does not give any satisfaction or relief to any heirs who will end up with that asset. I think this is the way to do it. To allow those people to stay in their house, and that's what we're seeing in Shakopee, is fixed income people being forced out of their home based on the escalating property tax, you know, floating everything up, and they have no relief. So I think this one was done right. It's a good bill.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Green, I understand the reasoning for the bill, but I'm thinking about a parcel of land or even a farm. If we're talking an 80-acre parcel of land, for example, would this only apply to the homestead, the house, garage, and 1 acre, so the rest of the property value could go up and the tax could go up on the rest of the parcel?
Maybe Mr. Hines or Representative Green?
Well, if Mr. Hines wants to answer it, but yeah, I think the answer is yes. But go
ahead. Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, Representative Green, the bill does specify that it would only apply to the house, garage, and 1 acre in a case of an ag homestead.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This bill doesn't freeze the property taxes. I think there's little. It just freezes the value. So I mean, on a school bond, they'd still have to pay, as the chair mentioned. So this isn't freezing property taxes for seniors. And I am wondering why it wasn't done more on an income based, because if you've got a couple that are just receiving the Social Security payment, that's maybe $36,000, and I can see that, but you might have some seniors making $100,000 too. And your point, I guess, is maybe they wouldn't get in the program, but you know, that's one strength, I think, of our property tax refund program, is that it goes by income. And basically, if you're making $30,000 as a couple, the first $600 of property taxes you would pay as the 2% threshold. Then after that, actually, the state would probably cover 70% to 80%. So I don't know if you're really solving that much of a problem here. And what may occur in some of these smallest of cities in rural Minnesota that have aging populations is that the only increase in market value is going to be maybe a minority of the homes where seniors aren't living and businesses. And ultimately, over time, you could force out your businesses and create a disincentive for new people to move into the community, and then actually in the long term, property taxes will heap up even greater on some of the homes that you're trying to protect. In a lot of these smaller communities that may only have 200 people, maybe 50 homes, and you know, and I know, in those homes, you go door knocking, a lot of senior citizens. So the value is only going to be ballooning out on just a few properties, and if that creates businesses to close, whatever, then all of a sudden everything is going to be back on those seniors, and even more so than it would be otherwise, because you're not going to have new people. So I do worry a little bit about these really small communities where it may not do what you're trying to do.
It kind of, Representative Markwart, it kind of puts the cash flow uncertainties or challenges maybe more on the government than on the seniors at that point, because that's what the bill is trying to affect, is the cash flow issues of seniors, because it's only the increment up that it freezes. And the other thing to think about is that, you know, when people die or sell their home, then there's going to be a chunk of money there that's going to go into the property tax pool too. So there will be maybe some ups and downs there. But anyway, Representative Green.
And yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Markwart, all those things were considered. And it was also looked at to do another income-based. But everything that you do gets complicated. And the reason for this is it's simple. And I do believe that, like the chair said, is one of the things that we discussed was that there may be a hit at first when people first come on. But as those houses go off the market, it should equal out. And I also don't believe that it's going to be widely used when you know you're going to pay it back. For instance, if I was over 65, if I had the money to pay the tax increases, I would gladly pay it because I knew that in the long run I'm going to pay it back when the house is sold, or if I transfer to my kids, it has to be paid back. So I think that you know, that storm you're talking about may not be as bad as people believe, and I do think it'll equal out. But like I said, my main concern is when you go to the counties, and I have all my counties, and looked at the number of tax forfeitures just this year. It becomes staggering when you look at our own plat books up in northern Minnesota, northwest Minnesota, and look at the amount of county tax forfeit lands in our books, which is also driving up our property taxes immensely. And so if we can keep these people in their house, even at that original property tax rate, instead of having them lose that to tax forfeit, the county's still going to be better off.
Thank you. Members, other questions? Good discussion. Seeing none, we have Representative Erickson renews her motion that House File 1551 be laid over for possible, that House File 1551 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion. Oh, excuse me. Mr. May, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tom May of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Each year we prepare a position statement that we've given to all members. And one of the points in that position statement is that MAAO believes adjustments to market values, such as limitation on assessors' estimated market values, acquisition values, deferments, exclusions, or exemptions, creates inequities between taxpayers. Another point is that we encourage a continued use of state-administered programs such as the property tax refund program, special targeted refunds, the income tax system, etc., if policymakers wish to grant additional tax relief. In this particular bill, the freeze is not means-tested. The property tax refund is. And we also have a senior citizens deferral program that's in law right now that they can do virtually the same thing. This bill would create shifts in tax burdens. It would shift it off the seniors who claim this exemption onto those other taxpayers in the district. Whether or not they would catch up at some point in time is, of course, the question. But it would create a shift because the rates would go up because of the decrease in tax base. And, again, I would say that we already have a system in place in Minnesota for the tax deferral if seniors choose to defer their taxes till a future date. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. May. Mr. Eggers.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Eggers with the Minnesota Realtors Association, representing roughly 18,500 realtors around the state. I was listening to the discussion that you were having on the A1 amendment and I think I just want to caution you about this payback at time of transfer when the property is sold. I think that is a significant issue that I'd urge you to think very carefully about. It's unclear to me. I did try to hear the answer to who would be responsible for the tax, the amendment. I mean, maybe I'm missing it, but it appears it could be negotiable unless Mr. Hines views it differently. It just says the tax would be due upon transfer, so I guess a buyer and seller could negotiate that, and maybe House Research could correct me if I'm wrong. But as I listen to the discussion, I think Representative Nelson raises a lot of good points on this. This is something that is going to be paid, but if it's going to be paid back when the property is transferred, that is going to affect the homeowner. And if you're in the program for a number of years and there's a significant amount of tax dollars that have to be repaid, that's that senior that was having trouble paying their taxes, I can't imagine they're not going to have trouble paying back this sum of money that's due from the taxes that were deferred as they were enrolled in this program. So I appreciate what Representative Green's trying to do. I think it is complicated. I'd urge you, Mr. Chair, as you're determining how to put this together, your recommendations together for the property tax article and how this might look, that we'd be happy to be part of that discussion with you to make sure that if this moves forward, that it does so in a way that doesn't catch seniors by surprise when they go to transfer their property or if it's passed on to family members, because it feels like this might sound like a good option for people and they enroll, but they don't think maybe carefully about the implications down the road when the tax bill becomes due. So I just wanted to raise those issues and get those on the record, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ager. Any further questions? With that, Representative Erickson renews her motion that House File 1551, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Green.
Thank you.
Representative Lunin moves House File 1711 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Lunin.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 1711. Members, thank you for hearing this bill. What this bill addresses is has a role in water quality. Currently, landowners can enter into federal programs such as the Reinvest in Minnesota or RIM program, Conservation Reserve program, which is the CRP program, which extends over a certain amount of years. And the current statute already acknowledges what the use of that land is and allowed to be zoned as a agricultural and stay as such, which is the information the landowner had when they made the decision to enter the program. What this bill, the simple bill, does is extend that same predictability to contracts with watershed districts and local municipalities where they get an agreement with a landowner to set land aside for different uses. How this affects my district is we down in Shakopee, the land of big fun, we've got development going on, and all of a sudden you could have a parcel come up for development adjacent to a set-aside property and a potential there to change the zoning of that set-aside property and the tax base for it. And the landowner is still committed to that contract and whatever that revenue source was going to be, but now the property tax they have to pay on the land goes way up, so they're actually lose money on it, and so it would become a disincentive for people to enter the program. I've got a couple of testifiers with me today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Loon, and who would like to testify first? Please step forward. Ms. Geis, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, Cindy Geis from Scott County, on behalf of Scott County at this time. I'm here just to talk a little bit more in detail about this provision. We had a couple of our taxpayers come into the county this year, and they were mortified. They got their proposed property tax notice, and they found that they lost their ag status. And it's because they entered into a local conservation program, and they were wondering, how could this happen? How could my taxes all of a sudden double? you lose an ag status, and in many cases, you possibly may lose your homestead as well because it's no longer ag. And residential taxes or rural vacant taxes are very difficult. The property tax rate goes up, as does your property taxes, and you lose any type of credit. So I'm here on behalf of Scott County, knowing that we do have a lot of conservation programs that our soil and water program offers, as well as our water management office, natural resources office offers. And any incentive for people to enter into those programs, for conservation programs, is not felt in the pocketbooks of our taxpayers because of the 100% or more increase in their property taxes. So I am here on behalf of the taxpayers of Scott County who wish to enter into these local conservation programs, and I ask that you please consider this bill as a method by which they still have the property tax relief that they currently have under the ag rule.
Thank you, Ms. Geis. Please introduce yourself, sir, for
yes,
the record.
Mr. Chair, other committee members, Doug Schenecker. I am currently the chair of the Scott Soil and Water Conservation District in Scott County. Also was employed by those folks for 37 years, so I do have a history of selling these programs. I just want to offer to you folks that right now, just to make it real simple, is the federal programs and the state programs are presently under a ag status, which means that their taxes will not go up 100 or more than 100% if the folks enroll. And it's kind of tough out there selling programs for our employees and myself when you say that there's federal monies out there, you can get into the federal programs, there's state money out there that you can get into the state programs. But now if you become part of the local funded programs through money through the Legacy Fund, for an example, we write grants for that money, local watershed districts, local water and soil resource county programs. If you want to get into that, your taxes are going to go up over 100%. Pretty tough sell out there to our homeowners or landowners. And our landowners see the big picture, folks. They see the big picture of water quality. They see the big picture of pollinators. They see the big picture of wildlife. They see the big picture of schools going out and learning in these fields, because they aren't growing corn and soybeans now. They're growing native grasses, what used to be here, to purify the waters, to provide habitat from pollinators to deer, in some cases northern Minnesota elk. And it's not only a Scott County issue, it's the whole entire state that we're considering here. So with that, I would hope that we would change one word in on the third page, 3.6, to add the word local along with all these other state and federal programs. To us, it only makes sense. And the reason why people look to these local programs, folks, is that there's not enough state money for RIM. There's a backlog on RIM. There's a backlog on CRP. And there's a backlog on CREP in our offices, not only in Scott County, but throughout the state. And that's why they look to some of these local programs, because we have money. We write grants, and we have good working relationships. We are the boots on the ground selling these programs, and please help us in selling these conservation programs. We do take the ag status or crop production status from the land and create all those new benefits. We all want water quality, you know, pollinators. We all live by them also. And so please, we would hope that you highly consider this bill.
Representative Hertaus has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I'm understanding this bill correctly, would it be correct for me to characterize that if property is zoned commercial or zoned industrial and is being used agriculturally, that through a management decision of enrolling in a program, that you would circumvent the higher commercial tax rate by putting it in a conservation program?
Mr. Schoenecker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Correct. Being that local monies are being used for our programs that we sell, again, and we also sell the federal programs and the state programs through our office. However, it's where the money comes from. So to make a long story a little shorter, hopefully, is that the local program, if people use our local monies, watershed district money, county money, legacy money that we write grants for, you're right. There, if they, we have two landowners with us today that chose to do the local program instead, and with the local program, their taxes have gone up over 100%. So I'm hoping that answers the question. If not,
is Ms. Geis still here or not?
Yeah,
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I'm aware that a lot of communities, particularly in the developing fringes, that have land use zoned commercial or guided commercial in terms of their long-term use. So usually land that's shown on a comprehensive plan that is guided may still be agricultural, but is still guided that way, and is, because it's still zoned agriculture, is taxed as agricultural. But I think what I'm hearing here is someone who owns property that is subject to its potential highest and best use of being commercial can circumvent the high taxation of commercial property by enrolling in a conservation program. So, Mr. Chair, I see this as a shift of part of that commercial burden.
Ms. Geis, can you talk about that relationship and what happens at the county level?
Mr. Chair, members, so the property is, through the zoning, of course, that's going to help determine what the value is. If it's zoned commercial, that base rate is going to be much higher. The property owners, if they choose to put property into conservation, we've never had properties that go in from commercial to conservation. They go from agricultural to conservation. They have to be in the ag status first. So the ag rules, for the purposes of CREP particularly, are that the property carries a value of agriculture, and it is currently had been agricultural for a period of time where a crop was taken off. Now they're going to conserve it. So you're not going to see commercial property that has none of that background come through and now put their property into a conservation program. The other deterrent is that properties at the highest and best use is actually commercial. They are under a conservation amount of time where they're not going to be able to do anything with that property for a period of time. So it's a landlock, similar to Green Acres. If you put your property into a Green Acres program, agricultural preserve or a metropolitan conservation program, you're not going to be able to do anything with it for at least a minimum of 8 to 10 years. So for someone who has a commercial property that's zoned commercial and that can be developed commercially, it's a very big disincentive to lock it up for any period of time in a conservation program just to receive, unless they plan on not developing on that property.
So, Ms. Geis, so tell us about the decision around the classification and how that works. So if you've got a piece of farmland that the city then suddenly rezones as commercial, given whatever is going on in the development of the city, how does that classification decision then on that piece of bean ground or whatever it is happen?
Mr. Chair, members, property classification is based upon use. Again, zoning will affect probably its highest and best use, so the higher the value. But if it's truly agricultural property and if it's mainly homestead, it's going to be valued and classified as agricultural property. So if a property is in a city or near development, and if it's currently zoned commercial, and they decide to till up the ground and place a crop, that next assessment year, the assessor is going to say, what was the property used for in the prior year? And if it was used agriculturally, they can classify that as agricultural. Now, remember, there also are other provisions where corporations cannot have agricultural property taxes, a property, unless they register themselves with, I think it's the Department of Ag, to get that status. So there's a couple things that they have to do if it's a corporate-owned piece of property. If it's truly an individual-owned piece of property and a zoned commercial, again, if they're using it agricultural, they're going to be classified in tax ag.
Now walk us through what happens if it's a piece of conservation ground and it's wooded or whatever, and suddenly it's rezoned. What's different there?
Mr. Chair, members, if it's currently in conservation, the conservation status sticks, regardless of the zoning. Again, the zoning may show us what its potential future value and future purpose and use is, but it does not change its current classification because it is conservation. If it's conservation now and conservation tomorrow, regardless of the zoning, it will continue to be taxed as in the agricultural realm. Again, its potential highest and best use, though, that top value, that may be a little bit different. And again, you're not going to see that right off the bat because it is a conservation program. It is under conservation program.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that a parcel of ground has to be at least 10 acres to qualify as agricultural. So in a case we're talking about here, if a piece of land was smaller than 10 acres, would you still try to get that ag classification rate on it if it's less than 10 acres?
Ms. Geis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there's a couple different provisions for property and the amount of acreage that they need as well. Now, of course, I'm an auditor, so I don't classify property, but I will talk. The assessor's office does report up through me through Scott County. If it's an intense use, or if the whole property, let's just say that property is only 8 acres, it doesn't have any structures on it, and it's entirely cropped from end to end, that property is classified as agricultural, and it's taxed as agricultural. The problem with the 10-acre limit exists when there are structures on it, a home that's on it, where all of a sudden the limit or the use of the property is deemed as residential rather than ag. So you have property owners that have 10 acres that may have some farming activities on it, such as agricultural, and they have their home on it. Those properties are classified as residential, and they're taxed as residential. If they're intensely farmed, such as they have a real big hog production or chicken production or to something to that level where it says that the use is intensive, then they could still get the ag class with a house. So the assessors know that there are many different rules and regulations that they need to follow and the statutes that they need to look at in order to determine highest and best use and what the classification of the property is.
Representative Anderson. Questions, members? Mr. Hickey? Welcome. Thank you, Ms. Geis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'll cut it. This is very brief.
Please introduce yourself first.
John Hickey from Prior Lake, Minnesota. Thank you. I'm probably the tip of the spear here, very typical case in point here. I've got a 250-acre farm that's been in the family since my Irish relatives settled out there in 1860. It's been an egg for forever. But I noticed that really it's a hilly area, and it's really not very appropriate for row crops. So I contacted the county, and they've been fantastic with making suggestions. So long story short, I now have 8 wetlands, 22 acres of filter strips, and I've had 2 plantings of prairie grass of 25 acres each. So thinking I was doing the right thing, and I did have this green acre status lost, and taxes did go up. I am a typical right at the edge of development, if you will, a Prior Lake, where there's the land and its best and highest purpose is very expensive land. So it's a real disincentive for me to really do any conservation efforts based on that. And, frankly, you might ask, why do local funds? Well, because local people, you can see them face to face. They can explain the benefits. It's been a very good working relationship over the last 20 years with the Soil and Water Group. Federal programs, you get various mailings. You might not ever see anybody. That's why it's so important that the local folks sell this to us, because they can explain it and they can perhaps offer add-on suggestions. So that's why we're here, to support the local Soil and Water Group, who, as they say, do a fabulous job. And they're the ones that are going to make sure that your benefits don't wash away, if you will, to use a pun here. I don't know how else they can really sell it, frankly, without having this tax benefit. It's a real, you take an arrow out of their quiver. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Ms. Whips, is it?
Yes.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Mary Whips, Jordan, Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm in the same situation. My husband and I had 16 acres that we worked with Scott County Soil and Water in 2011 to put into a conservation program with prairie grasses. We have land that runs into, there's multiple erosion issues going down into Sand Creek, which then runs into the Minnesota River. And we worked with Scott County Soil and Water to put 16 acres into this. My husband passed away in 2015, otherwise he would be here. So I just received information that my taxes were going to double because I would lose my ag status. I already lost the green acres status and paid for the back taxes on that also. But like he said, if we had known in 2011 when we were working on this that eventually our taxes would be doubled, I know that we wouldn't have participated in the program.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Thank you both. Representative Lunan, anything else?
I just appreciate you hearing the bill, and what it does is it encourages private landowners to do good things and hope for an affirmative vote.
Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 1711 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative Lunan moves House File 1741 to be entertained by the committee late.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 1741 appreciate hearing the bill. We're going to continue Cindy Geist Day at the Capitol with this bill. And what this bill does, members, is when a parcel of property is located in more than one county and there's a sale, the taxes or the fees that are collected at this point, it's the responsibility of each county to determine what percent of that property was in that county, contact the Department of Revenue to seek that. And what we're going to do, what we want to do is streamline that, because the Department of Revenue already has all of this information, to actually put the responsibility on the Department of Revenue. So the county that is collecting the funds would simply forward it to the Department of Revenue, and I'll let the testifier speak to the particulars.
Thank you, Ms. Geis.
Mr. Chair, members, Cindy Geis. I am the Legislative Chair for the Minnesota Association of County Officers and the Scott County Auditor Treasurer. I'm here on behalf of MACO for this provision. So mortgage registration tax is due on all mortgages in every county. It's $2.30 per $1,000. On mortgages over $10 million, where multiple counties are involved, the county is to collect 100% of that deed tax, submit the 97% of all mortgage registration tax to the Department of Revenue, and then for the remaining 3%, we're supposed to contact every single county that's included on that bill and ask them for what their most current value is, whatever their proportionate share of the value of the of each of the property. We then take the 3% and we allocate it and distribute it to each of the counties that are affected. Each year we submit values to the Department of Revenue. In fact, we submit values multiple times, as well as a whole laundry list of other types of items that they've requested to do their analysis and to bring forward information for you for fiscal notes and other purposes. But we had a conversation, we as in some of the other legislative committee members met with the Department of Revenue, and they talked to them about this provision.
They showed them the language, and what we heard back is that it is administrable from the Department of Revenue standpoint. So our request is that we take the whole amount of tax, submit it to the Department of Revenue. They keep their 97%, and based upon the records that they have, the most current values they have for the parcels that are included on that mortgage, they allocate to each of the counties their proportionate share. That will take a lot of the administrative burden off from the counties, as well as really streamline the process and make it more efficient. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Geis. Is the department here? Mr. Cummings, did you want to speak on this bill or not? Welcome, Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I just wanted to state what Ms. Geis has already said, that we do this. We do believe that this is administrable. We would have to try and figure out the best way in order to ensure that we can work with our partner counties in order to and to ensure how this would be administered, whether it's credits off of future payments or how that would work, but we do see this as something that could be administrable.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings, is there going to be a fee to counties for this, or will the Department of Revenue just do it?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the extent to what it would cost to administer. It may be something that could be done with our current resources, but I don't know right now, so that would have to be something we get back. Likely, unless it's directed under statute, we would not be charging a fee. We don't know what a fiscal note would be. It could be zero, though, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. You won't be asking for a fee, will you?
No, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and members, just so you know, this would involve properties that cross county borders and are valued at $10 million or more. So that's two subsets of properties that would qualify for this arrangement. The other thing you should know, and you didn't get my table this time, and I will forward it to you after the meeting, but I have requested a fiscal note on this. There are no revenue impacts as according to the revenue estimate in your packet, but I have requested a fiscal note, and those take longer to process. And so when I get that information for the administrative costs, I will make sure the committee has it.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. Would anyone else like to testify for or against the bill? Questions, members?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Hertos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment, Minnesota is one of the minority states that collects MRT and state deed tax, and if we're concerned about causing more affordable housing, we should rethink that policy.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Representative Lunan.
Well, members, this is one of the chairman's favorite kind of bills. This is a government efficiency bill, and kind of takes a couple of the links out of the chain, people that have to talk to each other regardless, so I appreciate the support.
Thank you. With that, Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 1741 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Lewick. Representative Whalen moves that House File 1247 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Lewick, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for hearing 1247. This bill would provide an increase in payment in lieu of taxes, commonly referred to as PILT payments, for county and state-owned land. That's tax-forfeited land either managed by the county or the state. It's really got three parts here. One would be a straightforward adjustment from $1.50 per acre to $2 per acre that would go to the counties, which would be redistributed down to the townships because you do have services provided not just at the county level. The other another area, it adjusts the cap on PILT payments for the Red River within the Red River Watershed Board. That PILT payments are figured there by a formula. So rather than do a number, you adjust the cap. That would raise those slightly. And the third part adjusts the payments on conservation lands. That's a very unique group of lands that are involved in nine counties in the northern part of the state. What would happen there is we would adjust the payment on basically back taxes from the point when the state took over these lands. There was taxes in arrears to the county. And so there's a long-term situation there that goes back to when the state took over the ditch assessment payments that went default when all this land in these nine counties, Aiken County North and West, went tax forfeit in the 30s. Just a quick reminder, I'm sure, I think most folks are generally familiar with what PILT payments do. They come down to the county. County's still got to plow the snow, got to provide law enforcement services. Local units have to provide fire protection, all those types of things. And without those payments, those costs goes directly on the private sector and all the rest of the landowners. Particularly this move from $150 to $2 an acre, it actually affects 86 counties of the 87 in the state of Minnesota. There is one county, I believe it's Rock County, that actually doesn't have land that would qualify under this, but this actually would make an adjustment that would go literally to 86 out of 87 counties. And I do have some folks that are available to testify, but I would leave it at the chair's discretion. If there's questions that I'm not able to answer, they're certainly available. But with that, I would open up the questions, Chair. But again, if we need testifiers, I certainly got them to get into the details.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. Members, questions? Okay, it appears maybe not. Representative Lewick, thank you for bringing forward House File 1247. Representative Whalen renews her motion that House File 1247 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Lewick.
Thank you. I love it when we do things this way.
Representative Lewick, did you mean when people bring treats here? Did you get in on the treats, too? The boxes are right there. They'll help you grow.
What are these?
They will.
Chair Drazkowski moves his House File 603 for possible inclusion. Welcome to your committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, House File 603 is language. It's the same language I brought forward before this committee in 2015, and what it does is it provides a it takes state surplus money and pays for 50% of the cost of the school construction property tax liability for each piece of open farmland, 2A, 2B, and 2C, I think all three of those classes, throughout the state of Minnesota. And so this is the one we call the Ag Bond bill. We had this same bill in the form of, instead of 50%, Mr. Chair and members, 40% in the last conference committee report of House File 848 last year, the bill that the governor vetoed. So very similar. What it does is takes the state resources and pays them to the school district on behalf of the farm operator that has that property tax liability for a school construction levy. That's what the bill does, and I'd stand for questions. So I think we've established throughout the last 3 years a very strong need for some assistance, Mr. Chair, for school construction levies for farmers throughout the state, as we've got a very ominous farm economy out there right now, as property values are very high. Crop values, current and projected, are not high and are struggling. And so this is something that certainly we need to address. And I know I've worked with Representative Markwart. He's got another bill to bring up, too, that's very similar. And he and I and others are continuing to work in this area to even bring it about further and hopefully bring forward the ability to transition to a house, garage, and an acre to bring actually farm property tax liabilities for school construction levies to be on par or equal with the people in town. But for now, Mr. Chair, this is what we have before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you have a testifier?
I have a testifier, but I didn't meet him yet. So,
all right. If you would state your name and who you represent for the record.
Yes, I'm Fred Nolan, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association.
Welcome, Mr. Nolan, to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, thank you for the strong introduction of this bill. I represent 223 school districts who educate 237,000 students daily. We support House File 603 on a 50% ag credit. Ag values have increased dramatically. They have backed off a bit in the last couple of years, but we do expect them to be sticky in greater Minnesota. Location is important to farmers, and so when a parcel comes available, that price is going to be sticky. We do not expect the collapse of the 1980s because most of the farmland was purchased with cash. We have now one-third of the districts have over 50% of their value in ag land, and 20% have 75% or more. So if you look at the front page of this handout, you can see the map of where the heavy ag districts are located. Debt service equalization has shrunk to 3% of all bond payments, 3% of school debt payments. Only 44 districts see any debt service equalization. So 100% of facility bond payments are paid by local taxpayers in all but 44 school districts in the state. And our school buildings have gotten older. Half our facilities were built before 1976, prior to the digital revolution. And facilities in districts with significant ag land are 10 years older than the state average. And because of the burden on farmers and low property values in greater Minnesota, bonds are passing at half the rate they are in the Twin Cities, about 40% in greater Minnesota and 80% of the Twin Cities. In fact, last November, none of the rural bond issues passed. In districts where the date on the lintel is 1902 or even 1890 or 1930, the imbalance of value and tax burden on farmers make it difficult or nearly impossible for these communities to even begin the civic discussion about what to do about their aging facilities. So creating a fairer balance in rural districts between homeowners, businesses, and farmers without increasing the tax burdens for homeowners and businesses is what the ag credit does. It lowers taxes for farmers in 284 districts. So if you flip the thing old map over and look at the backside, you actually see where the tax credit will go. Now, this is based on a 40% plan, so the numbers are a little off. But still, you can see the emphasis goes more toward the eastern part of the state, the central part of the state, where some of the highest ag tax burdens are because of the need to build facilities where you will also have ag lands. But it will also allow the other communities to have those necessary conversations. It's never easy to pass a bond, but you have to begin the conversation. In many communities, you can't even start because of the tax burden. This will become a solution when ag credit is significant. 40%, 50%, 100% are significant percentages. The ag credit will become useful when it's sustainable. School districts take out 30-year mortgages, and taxpayers need to be assured the rules will stay the same over the length of the mortgage. And finally, it will become a solution when we actually have a tax bill signed into law, as I'm sure you very much wish to have happen. So on behalf of farmers and children in rural Minnesota, I urge you to enact into law a significant, sustainable ag credit for school bond facilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative, I fully support the bill. It's a great start. I do have a question for Mr. Hines about how this could possibly work. Say a school puts up a bond issue and it passes, and a lot of the farmers vote for it based on this state credit. and it was mentioned it's a 30-year mortgage payback. What if 10 years down the road the state has a $6 billion budget shortfall and we can't guarantee that these payments continue? Does the state have any liability in this area when it's a 30-year bond issue passed and we have the credit in place? What would happen if the state, heaven forbid, but down the road, wants to eliminate the program? What would happen then?
Good question, Mr. Anderson, Representative Anderson. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, the state would not have any obligation to keep those payments coming. So if the state did, you know, repeal the program, the liability would fall to the farmers.
Representative Anderson.
That's what I suspected, Mr. Chair. It does, I think, give one pause for some concern, but this is an excellent start to address the problem, Representative. But, 30 years could be a long time. Thank you.
Questions from other members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
If I could, and Representative Anderson, that's a very good point. And members, I personally, having worked on this issue intensely for the last 3 years, still don't think this is the right way to do it. This is simply taking state money, income and sales tax money, and offsetting or subsidizing local property taxes. So the weaknesses that are inherent are the same ones that you mentioned, Representative Anderson. And when we looked at these, we've seen it from to a district in Minnesota, farmers are paying 10 times as much as their city cousins, 10 times as much as the people in town. So what this does is subsidize it down in half. They're still paying 5 times as much as the people in town. So in the future, when they vote on a referendum, they're going to be voting, and the people in town are also going to be voting, and the people in town are going to be voting for a liability 5 times as much for the people out on the farm. And so over time, and I know the schools are interested in this, because, and we all are, because we want rural school districts to be able to pass referendums when they make sense for them. But if we continue to have it at 5 times as much over time, it's going to start to do this again over time, I'm afraid, if we don't do it right. And I think the right way for us to go is to continue to be dedicated to looking at how we can get that house, garage, and acre, or get over to referendum market value, which is the way our operating referendums are, where the people out on the farm pay exactly the same amount per $100,000 of value as the people in town. Then you don't have these false things that are going on in here that are encouraging somebody to vote for a referendum that somebody else has to pay for. So I'm hopeful we can get to there, but we've kind of, I think, established, at least in the discussion, the public policy to this point, that this is at least doable. And I know Representative Marquardt is going to bring his bill up, and him and I are working on some other stuff we hope we can present before it gets too late into session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Drazkowski. I understand the issue about getting people to vote for school levies and why there's some relief needed. What I want to better understand is when you're saying that the farmers are paying 5 times more than or 10 times more than the people in town, are you referring to the businesses in town, the other businesses that operate commercial industrial, or are you referring to homesteads in town? I just want to understand what you're comparing.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, what we're looking at is people who happen to have their house located on a farm surrounded by farmland compared to people in town that simply live on a city block or somewhere maybe with a small parcel of land that doesn't have all of this liability attached to it. Like a farmer, school operating levies are already that way. So if you live on a farm with a school operating levy, you're only paying on that levy based on your house, your garage, and the acre of land that it sits on. Now, for construction levies, it works completely different. You're paying on your house, your garage, the acre of land that it sits on, and then all the rest of your farm acreage for that construction referendum. So we have two different approaches in law right now.
The goal is to get to one where both operating and construction levies are the same and treated the same, and then also where the person who happens to live on the farm, who, by the way, I would argue raises just the same number of kids per farm building as a person in town does, as we look at trying to tie the payment of services to the actual consumption of services, it only makes sense for the person in town who is at, you know, 1.3 kids or whatever that number is, or 1.5, I don't know what it is, the same as the people who happen to live on the farm.
Representative Loeffler.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Strakowski, that's helpful. And just so I better understand, rural operating levies and debt service levy, are commercial, industrial treated the same under both? You know, it sounds like ag property is treated differently, operating versus debt. Or you know, long-term capital bonds. How does it work for the owner of the grocery store in town?
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Mr. Hines can back me up, but the construction levies are on adjusted net tax capacity, and so that means that the commercial industrial buildings are at 2.0, Mr. Hines, and the homes are at 1.0 for class rate. On the operating levy, however, they're all on 1.0.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, that's essentially correct. We say they're at 100%, but it's the same effect. They're at the same level. And on this commercial industrial, slight clarification, it's 1.5 on the first 150,000 and then 2%. But, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Loeffler. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, anybody from the audience that would like to testify? We have the department. Welcome back, Mr. Cummins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Today I'll be speaking to both Representative Drazkowski's bill and Representative Markwart's bill. I reached out to both of the representatives late last night over email. So I want to thank you both for putting in these bills today. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith support creating school bond agricultural property tax credit. Representative Drazkowski's proposal pegs the reimbursement at 50% of the tax attributable to school bond levies, while the governor pegs his reimbursement to 40%. Representative Markwart, I believe, offers the full reimbursement. Farmers currently face high property taxes during economically difficult times, while some rural schools are having trouble raising money through referendums because the increase in property taxes falls so heavily on agricultural land. This proposal helps address the issue by reducing the property tax burden that falls on farmers, making it easier for schools to raise the money they need to provide quality education facilities for their students all across the state. As this bill moves through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, Chair Drazkowski, Representative Markwart, and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of this policy.
Thank you for those comments, Mr. Cummins. Any other questions? With that, closing comments, Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I did not mention, but Ms. Kelleher from the Minnesota School Board Association couldn't be here. She speaks very favorably of this proposal as well. Thank you for entertaining the bill.
All right. Thank you. And with that, Chair Drazkowski renews his motion to lay over House File 603 for possible inclusion. Next on the agenda is House File 171. Representative Markwart moves his bill for possible inclusion. House File 171 to your bill, Representative Markwart.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And there isn't much more to add. Representative Chair Drazkowski and Mr. Nolan, I think, covered this very, very well. This is the full meal deal, I guess, because it's kind of moving to what Representative Drazkowski and I are working on right now, is to try to move it just to the house garage and 1 acre. But, you know, quite frankly, it also comes down not only to trying to reduce property taxes for farmers who are facing this perfect storm right now with, you know, lower commodity prices, higher property taxes, and aging buildings. So they're having to go to this. But it also is an educational equity issue, because I think a student in rural Minnesota deserves just as much of an access to a high-quality facility as someone in the metro area. And what you're hearing is that because of this kind of untenable, unfair position we're putting farmers in, as Mr. Nolan said, you can't even kind of get to the discussion of looking at a bonding issue into your rural communities, because it's just such an unfair position for farmers. So hopefully this and the efforts of Representative Druskowski and that, you know, it was in the tax bill last year, and I know it garners pretty good widespread support. So nothing more to add other than this would really be important for districts. And, you know, just for example, in my area, Campbell Tinta, 94% is farmland. So when you get to a school bond, 94%. Norman County West, 90%. Ada Borup, 87%. Euland-Hitterdall, 78%. Rotse, 88%. The district I teach in, 64%. And these districts, because a lot of them are also smaller in school count but high ag land, their value per student so high is that they get no equalization from the state either. So there's just going to be no help for these districts anywhere else. So, members, thank you. I think we've talked a lot about this issue, and it should be a top priority.
And Representative Marquardt, do you have a sense, given those high proportions of ag classification and the owners, what is the percentage mix with regard to the number of residents in those districts as to how many live in town and how many are in the rural area?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a good question. I would say it is extremely high percent in the cities.
Okay.
And that's what you're seeing.
Yeah. All right. Any questions from members? Anyone from the audience? Seeing none, then Representative Marquardt renews his motion to lay over House File 171 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And with that, members, our meeting is adjourned.